Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton is Captain Robert Falcon Scott, and this is part two of our series on his Discovery Expedition. And as usual, my co-host is Max Musson from Western Spring. Well, shall we go back to a brighter period in our history, Max, and talk about our Greatest Britons, do you think?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, let's get into our Greatest Briton for the week, which is Captain Robert Falcon Scott once again, and we'll begin with a recap. Last episode, we heard how Scott met Clements Markham once again and discovered that he was planning a trip to the Antarctic. Scott was keen to go on this trip because it would give him the freedom to really explore what he was capable of. The expedition was arranged by the Royal Society and the Royal Geographical Society, but private investors and capitalists had to pay for the trip, simply for their own prestige and for that of their country. The Society simply wanted their scientists to be dropped off by a navy and for them to be in charge, but Markham insisted that the navy should be in charge, and it was only by luck that Markham's people were able to outvote the scientists, and Scott was then confirmed as the expedition leader. And that's where we got to last week. Is there anything else that you wanted to add to that, Max?
No, that seems fine.
Okay. Well, in December 1900, Professor Gregory arrived in Great Britain from Australia to organise his side of the expedition. When he got to London, he was shocked to learn of his position on the team, since he had expected the Antarctic command to have been placed under his direction. He expected to lead the expedition on the ice while Scott wintered over in Melbourne. According to Markham, instead of going to work on his scientific program, Gregory set about conspiring with the hydrographers to have Scott's leadership role overturned. But try as he might, Gregory was unsuccessful in his bid to capture the command. In May 1901, Gregory was sent a telegram with a choice to either serve under Scott's command or to resign. Gregory resigned in disgust. Dr. George Murray, the head of the Botanical Department of the British Museum, was appointed in his place, on the condition that he go only as far as Melbourne to give scientific advice and training to the other scientists, and then to return to his duties at the museum. Gregory went on to occupy the chair of geology at Glasgow University for 25 years, and at the age of 68, while crossing a river in Peru, he drowned. So he was still lively in his elder years. Is there anything on that that you want to pick up on, Max?
Well, just that there was this this controversy about Scott's leadership, with the scientists wanting the scientists to lead the expedition, but with the contrary viewpoint, which was Clements Markham's viewpoint, that Scott, as the naval commander, should be the person who has ultimate responsibility for deciding the course of the expedition. And when one considers the dangerous conditions into which they were venturing, then that really was the most sensible point of view.
Oh, yeah. I should imagine the guy that ended up in, well, the original fellow probably never actually been to the Antarctic before, and probably had no idea of just what a trial of endurance it was actually going to turn out to be. After his meeting with Markham in June 1899, Scott went back to sea and resumed his duties aboard the HMS Majestic. And on June the 9th, 1900, he received his letter of appointment, and 2 days later, he wrote a formal letter of acceptance to the committee. A follow-up letter arrived on the deck of the two presidents shortly thereafter, in which Scott had written, "Number one, I must have complete command of the ship and the landing parties. There cannot be two heads. Number two, I must be consulted on all matters affecting the equipment of the landing parties. Number three, the executive officers must not number less than four, exclusive of myself. Number four, I must be consulted in all future appointments, both civilians and others, especially the doctor. Number five, it must be understood that the doctors are first medical men, and secondly, members of the scientific staff, and not vice versa. Number six, I am ready to insist on these conditions to the point of resignation, if, in my opinion, their refusal imperils the success of the undertaking. I'll just stop there. I wonder what his point there is so insistent about. I can understand all of them, but the bit about the doctors have got to be first medical men, secondly members of the scientific staff. I guess because the health is most important, but I'm just trying to imagine any situation that might occur where they would actually have to make a choice between that. Possibly because of the mission and they wanted to continue the mission, the scientists wanted to continue the mission. But the medical men were saying, well, no, we can't on health reasons, possibly. I mean, what do you think of these 6 points that he brings up here, Max?
Well, I think in view of the fact that his authority has been challenged so severely so far, I think it's reasonable that Scott would want to set out very clearly what he thought were his prerogatives. I think as far as the rule number 5 that he sets out, which is that it must be understood that the doctors are first medical men, it is pretty much as you said. I think that if they're going to be venturing into extreme conditions where the health of other members of the team is going to be placed in jeopardy, then what he needs is for the scientific staff to be watchful of each other's physical condition and also watchful and careful of the physical condition of the naval people that are accompanying them. And if you're in a situation where somebody could go on to make a scientific discovery, leaving behind other members of the expedition team who have become ill as a result of their exposure to the extreme cold, etc., then as far as Scott is concerned, then looking after the men that a part of the expedition comes before scientific discovery.
His men come before anything else, so he's a good leader. Scott went on leave for a few weeks and then started work by taking a course in magnetism at Deptford. Living with his two sisters and his mother over a shop in Chelsea, Scott started his day by jogging across Hyde Park for exercise before plunging himself into the planning for the expedition. Extraordinary details had to be worked out, and even Hugh Robert Mill, the distinguished librarian of the Royal Geographical Society, thought that Scott, if anyone, could bring order out of the chaos which had overtaken the plans and preparations. So it does sound like they're encountering some difficulty there. In October 1900, Scott and the Markhams went to Christiania in Oslo to consult Nansen. And I think Christiania is actually the Free State in... it's Oslo, Norway, isn't it? I'm thinking of Christiania in Denmark is the... Free State. He went to Norway, Christiania in Norway, to consult Nansen. His vessel, the Fram, had just returned intact with her crew after drifting right across the Arctic from the Siberian Sea to emerge after 35 months north of Spitsbergen, which proved the Arctic region to be an ocean rather than a continent. The Fram was designed like a saucer so that she would be lifted above the ice floes rather than crushed by them. It was a revolutionary design, but to reach the Antarctic, a ship would have to cross terrible seas and force her way through hundreds of miles of ice pack, so they thought a whaling vessel would be more suitable. Ironically, Amundsen later borrowed the Fram from Nansen and sailed her to Antarctica and right into the Ross Sea. Scott and Nansen quickly became fast friends. Of Nansen, Scott would write to his mother, "He is a great man, absolutely straightforward and wholly practical, so our business flies along apace. I wish to goodness it would go as well in England." Later, Nansen wrote of Scott, "I see him before me, his tight, wiry figure, his intelligent, handsome face, that earnest, fixed look, and those expressive lips, so seriously determined and yet ready to smile. The features of a kindly, generous character with a fine admixture of earnestness and humour." Nansen told him to get dogs, so he did as Nansen suggested and bought them in Russia. It was suggested that he buy Greenland dogs, which were bigger and better, but they were hard to get as the many Arctic expeditions of the previous 50 years had taken a toll on the supply of these dogs. 20 dogs and 3 bitches were selected in Archangel and sent to the London Zoo, where they were kept until they could be shipped to New Zealand. So no snowmobiles here. They're going to be using dog sleds to make their way across. I'm quite interested in this this shape of this vessel, shaped like a saucer. I mean, you wouldn't have thought that that would have been able to make its way through the sea without having bows there, but apparently it was okay. Got any comments on this, Max?
I would have thought that it probably would have had a very deep keel, even though the actual cross-section of the ship would have been saucer-shaped. So it would have been a saucer with a deep keel projecting down into the water. The reason why I assume that probably would be the case is that if you have a very broad, flat-bottomed ship, then in difficult seas, in very turbulent seas, that ship will toss from one side to the other and will be very unstable, whereas a ship that's got a deep keel will tend to be more stable. And that was part of the principle by which the ships of Sir Francis Drake were able to defeat the Spanish Armada, because the Spanish ships were very large, broad-bottomed and flat-bottomed ships that were tossed around in the stormy seas around the British Isles to a far greater extent than the wooden wolves, as they were called, the British naval vessels, which were narrow with a very deep keel. I would think that probably would be the case with the Fram, that it would although the actual hull of the ship wouldn't go deep into the water, it would have a shallow hull but a very deep keel.
You know, I'm just thinking about these dogs here as well. I mean, you would have thought that they would have wanted to get used to the dogs so that the dogs got used to their owner, so there was a relationship between the dogs and the owner. But no, they're actually putting them in the zoo. I wonder if they went to visit them or anything like that. I mean, I did think that dogs had to well know, had to get used to their owners to build up a relationship. Don't you think, Max, do you keep dogs? Do you think this is a bit strange, keeping them in the zoo until they could then be shipped to New Zealand and then just used by them as if they were machinery?
Well, I think that as far as huskies are concerned, they tend to be less tamed than most domestic dogs would be. So I think the experience that most people will have with a domestic dog will be entirely different to that of husky. I mean, there are some huskies that are bred for their calm personality, but I think as far as the huskies that would be used for Arctic and Antarctic expeditions, they would be dogs that would be far more hardy, and they would be therefore from a genetic point of view, far more closely related to wolves than domestic dogs, and so they probably wouldn't have made good house pets, but they would have been extremely good at pulling a sled. And as long as you had a good relationship with the dog that would be regarded as the alpha male amongst the huskies, then that probably would be sufficient for you to control the other dogs that made up the rest of the pack.
Yeah, so they'd be working as a pack, wouldn't they, rather than be working as individuals. Well, let's have a look at the crew then that he selected. On May the 29th, 1900, Albert Armitage was appointed to serve as second in command and navigator. Armitage, aged 36, came from the Merchant Navy, where he had been an officer in the P&O fleet. His prior experience came from his participation as navigator with the Jackson-Harmsworth Arctic Expedition of 1894. The expedition's primary goal was to determine if Franz Josef Land was part of a continent which might extend all the way to the North Pole. Armitage and seven others landed at Franz Josef Land and proceeded to spend 3 years in a hut within the 80 degrees north circle, shooting polar bears and doing scientific research. But Franz Josef Land was simply a series of scattered islands that had been incorrectly mapped by their discoverer, Julius Payer. One day, Armitage was searching the area with his field glasses when he spotted someone approaching on skis. The man was covered in oil and grease and black from head to foot. It was Nansen. Nansen and one companion had left the Fram and her crew to make a dash for the North Pole. Unfortunately, they too soon discovered the impossibility of such a trek. They wintered in a tiny hut, living on bear meat in a latitude of 86.13 degrees north, the furthest north record that stood until Peary reached the pole in 1909. Nansen and his companion had been dragging sledges and two kayaks, having eaten all the dogs by them, across 700 miles of ice, hoping to reach Spitsbergen, where whaling vessels occasionally called. Finding Armitage had saved their lives, as a trip across the open seas to Spitsbergen in kayaks would have resulted in certain death. They returned to civilization in July 1896 in the Windward. I mean, that is a stroke of luck, isn't it, that they just happened to come across this hut here. I imagine what they would have done otherwise. They would have just tried it in the kayaks, wouldn't they, I guess?
Yeah, that's right. And with almost certainly disastrous results.
And you can also think, I mean, at this time, that they're relying on these maps that have been drawn, but they haven't properly got a proper idea of where it is that they're actually going to, because it hasn't been properly mapped. I mean, even at this time, in 1894, they're discovering that what they thought was part of solid land is actually just a series of scattered islands. I guess they'd just been connected together by ice when they originally got there. And also, they didn't have the sou'westers that we have now either. So in order to keep themselves or protect themselves from the cold, it was whale grease and seal grease and seal oil that they would cover themselves in. So when you see the pictures of them, they're literally black from head to foot. And that's all this oil and grease that they put on. And they got that idea from the Inuit, from the Eskimos. You know, that's how they keep themselves warm. So yes. Difficult to keep yourself clean in those temperatures. Well, the doctor on the Jackson Harmsworth expedition to Franz Josef Land had been a Reginald Koetlitz, a 6-foot-tall man with a drooping moustache of German heritage. At the age of 39, Koetlitz received his appointment in 1900. Markham described him as a very honest, good fellow, but exceedingly short on common sense. However, Koetlitz was correct in his agreement with other notable doctors that scurvy, the plague of all polar expeditions, was caused by a poison resulting from putrefaction of preserved food, and the remedy for it was absolutely pure food. So again, they didn't even properly understand about nutrition at this time, but he was correct about that. It's interesting that Markham sees he's a very honest and a good fellow, but he's a little bit short of common sense. He's been very truthful here, and the drooping moustache of a man of German heritage, when we still had these little differences between our European ethnicities. The assistant surgeon was a young man recently qualified at St. George's Hospital. He had a wonderful talent for drawing and painting in watercolours. He was a deeply religious man, and he had a passion for birds. His name was Edward Adrian Wilson, the son of a Cheltenham doctor. A courageous young man, Wilson spent too many chilly nights birdwatching, too many long nights with his studies to make up for time spent in art galleries, too much starving himself so he could give money to beggars or to buy books, and probably too much smoking. He ruined his health and contracted pulmonary tuberculosis. After spending 2 years in Norway and a Swiss sanitarium, he shook the disease. But as soon as he began his duties as junior house surgeon, he contracted blood poisoning, which resulted in a painful abscess in his armpit. When Scott met him in 1900, his arm was still in a sling. Scott appointed him on the spot, but he still had to pass an Admiralty medical board. He failed the first time and the second exam only weeks before sailing, with a report saying Mr. E. A. Wilson unfit on account of disease in the right lung. Scott told Markham he must have him. And Wilson told Scott, I quite realise it will be kill or cure, and have made up my mind that it will be cure. Dr. Wilson's contributions to the expedition were enormous, and his incredible gallery of original artwork left for our enjoyment is highly prized and very valuable. And I mean, I was thinking at the beginning there, well, he's the assistant surgeon. You know, what is so important about him being able to draw and paint in watercolours? And I guess because it made up for photography, so he was able to paint the pictures. So it was actually very important what he was doing. And I guess we'll hear more about his contributions later on. Do you want to add anything to that about the assistant surgeon, Max?
Well, just that he's the sort of person who, from the description you've given of him, there is somebody who is single-minded in everything that he does, And that's the kind of mentality that you need to have if you are going to achieve great things. It's one thing I've noticed in all sorts of fields of endeavor, that for somebody to achieve at a very high level, they need to have this sort of single-mindedness of purpose, where they can ignore the more frivolous things in life that would otherwise distract someone.
Yeah, it's not all about qualifications, is it? It's also very much about character. And so it's interesting the way that they're describing the characters of the crew here as well. The three naval officers appointed at about the same time as Scott were Charles Royds as first lieutenant, Michael Barn as second naval lieutenant, and Reginald Skelton as chief engineer. Royds' charge was to deal with the men and the internal economy of the ship. He was serving on HMS Crescent, which was the flagship on the North American station at the time of his appointment. Michael Barn had been educated at Stubbington School in preparation for the Navy and later served with Scott on HMS Majestic. Reginald Skelton also served with Scott on the HMS Majestic. A Norfolk man, he had joined the Navy as an engineer student in 1887 and served in various ships on various stations until Scott finally met him when he was appointed the senior engineer on the HMS Majestic. There were still three scientific positions to be filled, and the first of those, as naturalist, was offered to a Scot, W.S. Bruce. Unfortunately, he was busy organising his own Scottish expedition, the Scotia, in 1902, and he declined. The position was then offered to Thomas Vere Hodgson, aged 37, director of the Marine Biological Laboratories in Plymouth. And Markham writes about him, "A bit young to have a polished, bald head, sometimes needing a skull cap, but otherwise apparently strong and healthy." In actual fact, having a bald head is a sign of high testosterone, so it may have been something that you would be looking for in somebody young, because it would say that they're going to be particularly strong, maybe particularly bright. I mean, they have found a link with high testosterone and high intelligence now as well. But back then, I guess they thought a bald head, a little bit too young to have a bald head, that may be a sign that, I don't know, really. What do you think what do you think his worry was about being a bit young to have a bald head meant, Max? Any ideas?
No, I'm not really quite sure. I had a friend at school who was completely bald by the time he was 17. His hair just seemed to age sort of dramatically fast, and he always had a shiny bald head from that point onwards. I've known other people that have had completely bald heads, I've not really noticed that it is as a result of anything that would necessarily concern somebody who was planning an expedition.
It's interesting, isn't it, that we used to wear wigs to, you know, men used to wear wigs and wish to show that they had lots of hair, but in actual fact it's the people whose hair falls out that actually have the most testosterone. The geologist Hartley Ferrar, aged 22, had just graduated from Cambridge with an honours degree. Born in Ireland and raised primarily in South Africa, Markham felt he was capable, but very young, very unfledged, and rather lazy. However, he most likely could be made into a man in this ship by the young lieutenants. The physicist was Louis Bonacci, aged 25. His appointment was so late in coming that he had to join the ship in New Zealand. He had spent a very adventurous childhood on a mountainous island that was uninhabited except for his family and their dependents. His father was a silk merchant from Lombardy and had bought the island from the Tasmanian government for £20,000. Louis studied physics and astronomy at the Melbourne Observatory and was the only member of the expedition to have prior experience in the Antarctic. He had spent 2 years with Borch Grevink's Southern Cross expedition and had wintered over in the hut at Cape Adare. Markham declared him always grown up, never a boy. And I should imagine he did mature well. I mean, living on your own on an island, I guess he's just got his family there. I guess there can't have been many distractions. What do you make of these descriptions here and the crew that he's got here, Max?
Well, living on an island, I think, is It sounds strange, but it depends how many other people he had there, because it mentions that they were alone apart from their family and their dependents. And so it depends very much on who the dependents were. It could well be that if the man was wealthy enough to buy an island for £20,000, which in those days would have been an immense amount of money, that he would have been fabulously rich, and that they probably would have had lots of servants. And so I would think that the family weren't quite as alone as one might imagine nowadays. I think, you know, if you were a young boy who together with your siblings had an island to explore, then that would be an absolutely wonderful thing for developing a sense of adventure. And so I imagine that he would have been that sort of a person.
They're collecting people from all over the white world as well, aren't they? You know, they're not limiting themselves to just people from Britain. They've got people from all over. And I like the way he's telling us about their heritage as well as where they were born. You know, so nurture and nature. It's the environment people are brought up in as well as their ancestral heritage. I like the way this is all described. They would just be telling you where they were born now. They wouldn't be telling you what their ancestry was. Well, the next one, of course, is one of our former greatest Britons that we have already covered, Ernest Shackleton. Ernest Shackleton was an unusual choice. He was a merchant navy officer like Armitage, but no one had invited him to join. Shackleton went to sea at the age of 16 as an apprentice in a sailing vessel, and his captain considered him the most pig-headed, obstinate boy I ever came across. But he worked his way up the ladder and was soon the third officer in a Union Castle liner. He became engaged to be married and told his future father-in-law, "My fortune is all to make, but I intend to make it quickly." And unfortunately, he lost a lot of money, if I remember rightly. He was very ambitious, but he had no special interest in the polar regions or scientific research, for that matter. He applied to join the expedition and was promptly turned down. In Shackleton's case, it was a simple who-you-know matter. Llewellyn Longstaff, who had been the first to pledge financial backing to the expedition, had a son who was a passenger to Cape Town on the liner in which Shackleton served. The two men became friends, and Shackleton persuaded young Longstaff to set him up for an interview with Armitage. The second-in-command was impressed and recommended him to Scott, who in February 1901 appointed him third lieutenant in charge of holds, stores, provisions and deep seawater analysis. Armitage wrote, "His brother officers considered him a very good fellow, always quoting poetry and full of erratic ideas." Shackleton was forced to leave the expedition in 1903 and was replaced by George F. A. Mulock, who remained with the expedition until conclusion. Mulock was only 21, but had received excellent instruction as a surveyor in HMS Triton, and his services provided were invaluable. This concluded the complement of primary officers and scientists. The Navy also released 3 warrant officers and 6 petty officers, including Edgar Evans and David Allen from the HMS Majestic. Interesting to see the sort of character arc here from when Shackleton started off and he was pig-headed and obstinate, and he makes his way through this excursion, this expedition to the Antarctic. And then, of course, he goes off on his own expedition and possibly the greatest story of endurance ever told, which we discussed in our episode on Ernest Shackleton. Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Max?
Well, again, it's people with single-mindedness of purpose and determination, which could also be interpreted as obstinacy, that is a common factor with a lot of these people.
And also, he kept morale high, didn't he? He was always reading poetry to them or quoting poetry to them, and he had erratic ideas. You know, you have to think about how the crew are going to get on with one another as well. They have to be people that are going to be able to be within an enclosed space just with this group of people for months, possibly years. So you have to be certain that they're not going to be the sort of people that are going to take offense at at little things. They're not going to be the sort of people that are going to start fights. They're going to need to be people that are extremely self-disciplined and there are also friendly people that are not going to get depressed if things aren't going their way. You want people that are always going to be cheerful. And that was the great thing about Shackleton. He was always cheerful, and he made certain that the morale in his group on his expedition was kept high, even when, you know, he had to leave parts of the group behind and it seemed as if all was lost, that he still made certain that they kept morale high. Okay, well, let's get into our Greatest Britons for today then, and we'll be talking about Captain Robert Falcon Scott once again. Last episode, we learned about the crew members that Scott picked for the expedition, and we really appreciated Clements Markham's notes on them, pointing out that one was too young to have a bald head, another with a drooping moustache of German heritage, and one who was rather unfledged and lazy, but would be made into a man by the ship's young lieutenants. We heard about how they had to settle for Russian dogs instead of Greenland ones, and how they were left at the London Zoo until they could be shipped to New Zealand. And we discovered that much of the Arctic regions had yet to be mapped, and the adventurers were really heading into completely uncharted territory. Finally, we heard how Ernest Shackleton joined the team, and he was the only one to actually apply for the job. And he had to do that through striking up a friendship with the son of one of the financial backers of the trip. Is there anything else that we should remind listeners of, or anything else you want to add to that, Max?
Well, just that I think we mentioned when we were talking about the, you know, the parts of the approaches to the Arctic and Antarctic not being properly mapped. Well, the Arctic, rather, that's what we're talking about, isn't it? The not being properly mapped. And it just made me sort of think of an uncle of mine who, during the Second World War, served on the ships that were sent round to Archangel in the northern part of Russia to supply the Russians with weaponry, etc. And just his, you know, stories that he told about how freezing cold it was in those conditions, and the clothing that they had to wear, and how grim it was. And so from that perspective, I'm sort of fully prepared to visualize just how cold it's going to be for Scott and the other explorers when they're on this expedition.
Yeah, that Bering Sea is absolutely freezing there. You think about the fishermen at work in the Bering Sea as well. Well, we'll actually find out some more about the vessels that they were in now. The Discovery, that was the ship that they used, was built at Dundee. She was the sixth of her name and the first to be specifically designed and built for scientific work. She had to be a wooden ship to withstand the pressure of the ice, since steel would simply buckle. She also had to be a sailing ship, but with auxiliary engines. The ship was to be exceptionally strong, built from a variety of timbers, English oak for the frames, 11 inches thick, Riga fir for the lining, 11 inches, Honduras mahogany, pitch pine or oak for the 4-inch thick lining, all sheathed with two layers of planking, 26 inches of solid wood in all. Her bow was incredibly strong. Some of the bolts running through the wood were 8.5 feet long. The vessel was 172 foot long and 34 foot wide, of 485 tons register, and a displacement of 1,620 tons. She had to have room to store fuel, oil, 350 tons of coal, fresh water, dog food, medical supplies, scientific instruments, axes and saws, a sectional wooden hut, a piano, and a library. Invitations for bids were offered, but only two were received. On December the 14th, 1899, a contract with the Dundee Shipbuilding Company was signed. The keel was laid on March the 16th, 1900, and the final cost, including the engines, was £49,277. I mean, that's all quite incredible there, isn't it? They had to build it out of wood. I mean, that's the first thing that surprises me. And then they're actually specifying exactly what type of, what country the wood has to come from. English oak, Riga fir, Honduras mahogany. So there must be subtle differences just between the trees that actually grow in the countries. And the size of those bolts, 8.5 foot. What do you make of the boat, Max?
Yeah, well, it's certainly an impressive vessel, and all the things you've just said about the thickness of the wood, the different characteristics of the wood in order to give it the strength, but also the flexibility, the size of those bolts. And you often see old buildings, historic buildings nowadays, where the walls have started to buckle or subside, and where bolts are put through a house from one side to the other, and those bolts can be very long, perhaps 30 or 40 foot long in some cases. So 8 foot long bolts isn't that incredible, but in terms of it being a boat, then they are extremely long bolts, and you can just imagine really the in-depth knowledge that the boat makers would have necessarily had to have had in order to have got all of these details right, so that the boat would have precisely the right characteristics in terms of its buoyancy and in terms of its strength.
Yeah, cost as well, £49,000. That's all. I mean, that would cost millions, I should imagine, to do something like that today. Also, you think of they're taking a piano and a library, and all they would need to bring today is a smartphone, and they would have all the access to the internet on a smartphone. But back then, they have a whole library and a piano, so that they can play the piano, so they've got music, so they can keep their spirits high. You know, very, very important to keep up morale. On March the 21st, 1901, Lady Markham, with a pair of golden scissors, cut the tape, and the Discovery was launched. Food for the 47 men was stored aboard. 150 tons of roast pheasant, 500 of roast turkey, whole roast partridges, jugged hare, duck and green peas, rump steak, wild cherry sauce, celery seed, blackcurrant vinegar, candied orange peel, Stilton, and double Gloucester cheese, 27 gallons of brandy, 27 gallons of whiskey, 60 cases of port, 36 cases of sherry, 28 cases of champagne, lime juice, 1,800 pounds of tobacco, pemmican, raisins, chocolate, and onion powder. And I'll just stop there. I mean, think of all that alcohol. I mean, I don't know if they allow alcohol on the space station. I guess that's the only thing you could probably compare to it today. But I think that would be very different today, the supplies that they were bringing with them. Don't you think, Max?
Well, sailors in times gone by, particularly those that were sailors of warships, were given a very considerable ration of alcohol each day, which I've always assumed was so that they would be in a fighting spirit when they encountered the enemy. And but certainly from that list of things there, with the cheeses and the orange peel and the cherry sauce and the jugged hares and the duck and everything else, they certainly were intent on eating well. And it reminds me actually when you were going through the all of the money that they would need to raise, etc., just reminded me of a previous Greatest Britain that we've had, which was Sir Ranulph Fiennes, and the fact that firstly he had to go through a in meticulous detail composing a list of all the things that they would need for the trips that he organized, but also the fact that I'm pretty sure it was his group that one of his expeditions where they invented the idea, I'm not quite sure what they called it now from memory, but wasn't it something like rum o'clock or something like that, where they all had a daily ration of rum in order to keep their spirits high?
Yeah, that was it. It was called rum o'clock. I should imagine that they were probably thinking, but it's going to warm them up as well, and a little treat at the end of the day to have a top of brandy or whiskey. But it just seems like quite a lot there, doesn't it? 27 gallons. And then, of course, the champagne, 28 cases of champagne. I should imagine that would have been for celebrating being the first to discover something. And then you've also got to think about Christmas, because they're going to be spending Christmas there as well. They're going to be wanting to celebrate that. While being loaded, many visitors came to see her. Among them were two former colleagues of Sir James Clark Ross, Sir Erasmus Ommaney, now aged 87, who had sailed with Ross to the Arctic in 1835, and the famous botanist Sir Joseph Hooker, the naturalist in James Clark Ross's Erebus and Terror expedition. It was upon Hooker's advice that Scott found £1,300 to purchase a balloon for the voyage. With much fanfare and a Godspeed service on board, the Discovery weighed anchor on July 31st, 1901, pausing at Spithead to correct her compasses and proceeded to Cowes to receive the royal blessing. The new king and queen, still uncrowned, came aboard. The queen's Pekingese actually fell overboard, and one of the sailors had to rescue it. The next day, August the 6th, the Discovery passed the Needles on her way to the unknown. As Markham noted, truly they form the vanguard of England's chivalry. No finer set of men ever left these shores, nor were men ever led by a finer captain. And that really reminds me of the stuff that was sort of written during the Crusades, and just this idea of chivalry and England's finest men. And they used to be knights, and now they're adventurers. And you got the king and the queen that are going on board as well in order to give it their blessing. It's a real sort of family affair, isn't it? Back when, you know, when we were still an extended
halcyon
family.
Days, as they call them.
Yeah, definitely halcyon days. Well, the Discovery was so heavy in the seas that she could not make more than 7 knots, and this became an immediate concern as New Zealand was 14,000 miles away. Her first stop was at Madeira Island, where they took on more coal and sent back considerable mail. But after leaving Madeira, the men were shocked to find that the Discovery was leaking water into the hold, and as a result had ruined a significant amount of the food. What could be dried was saved, but the rest was thrown overboard. The ship arrived in Cape Town on October the 3rd, 1901, where nearly everyone proceeded to get drunk. Owing to the slowness of the voyage, Scott decided to cut the Melbourne leg out of the journey and sail directly to Lyttelton, New Zealand. As a result of this decision, Dr. Murray was left in Cape Town so that he could return to his post at the British Museum. The Discovery arrived at Lyttelton at the end of November, where the leak at last received attention. Meanwhile, the hospitality extended to the crew was generous, at the very least. Royds wrote that there was not a single sober man on board. The men are rushed at as soon as they get ashore, and all good service feeling is lost, and I have awful times. Better men never stepped a plank whilst they are at sea, but in harbour they are nothing but brute beasts, and I am ashamed of them, and told them so, and penitent indeed they are, but only until they are drunk again. Scott wrote that the drunken men disgust me, but I'm going to have it out with them somehow. There are only a few black sheep, but they lend colour to the flock. A few were discharged and replaced. The men were nearly all bachelors, and the young sailors soon were welcomed right into New Zealand homes. Skelton lived with the Mears family and eventually married the youngest daughter, Sybil, while Ferrar went on to meet his future wife in Christchurch. So sailors don't change, do they? Even when they're ferrying scientists to the Antarctic, they are they're still going to get drunk once they get to the shore. And I think we can see here in Scott, because he missed out on that going out and enjoying with his friends, because all his money was being sent back home to his mother to fund his mother once his father died. So he missed out on that going out with all his comrades while he was working his way up in the Navy. So he doesn't really understand the need to go out and have fun. So he's disgusted at it. And I like his turn of phrase here. There are only a few black sheep, but they lend colour to the flock. I've heard of the black sheep before, but I haven't heard it put there that they would lend colour to the flock as well. While in New Zealand, Scott was to receive some good news from Markham. The men had determined that a relief ship would be needed to resupply the Discovery the following year and, of course, check on their condition. In May 1901, Mr. Llewellyn Longstaff contributed £5,000, which Markham used to purchase the Morgannon. In September, she sailed from Norway to England, where she was refitted and renamed the Morning. Lieutenant William Colbeck, RNR, was appointed her commander. Colbeck had Antarctic experience, as he had been the magnetic observer on Borch Grevink's Southern Cross expedition. On December the 21st, the Discovery was escorted by HMS Ringarooma and HMS Lizard out of the harbour as cheering crowds stood on the shore waving farewell. And this ship, the Morning, this second ship, really proved very, very useful with transferring mail, bringing mail to them and taking mail back once a year. And it will play quite an important role as we make our way on through the story. Is there anything you want to pick up on there or add to it, Max?
I think the observations you made about Scott not appreciating the drunkenness of his men. But I think that in any situation where people, where you know, a group of men are going into a very harsh environment and going into a very dangerous kind of adventure, then that there is a lot of bonding that takes place as a result of the laughs and the jokes that the men have together. That helps to hone them into a team where they look after each other and they're prepared to sacrifice and make the ultimate sacrifice for the safety of the others in the most extreme cases. And so, you know, that's something which is sort of fairly easily understood from the point of view of looking back with hindsight at what took place there.
Yeah, and Scott didn't quite understand it. That was the bit that had been missing from his sort of naval education. I also find it interesting that two of them then got married as well. You know, these young bachelors. I mean, they would have had a lot of fame for going on this expedition. And this is the way that it was back then. You would meet a woman and you would you would get married. There wasn't much of this dating that goes on today, trying out different partners. It was you meet somebody, you fall in love, and you would propose, and you would get married straight away. Usually at quite a young age. Well, soon after crossing the Antarctic Circle, they entered the ice pack. Just before midnight on January the 8th, 1902, Royds sighted land off the port bow. They headed for Cape Adare, where Borch Grevink's party had wintered and soon landed on the beach. From Cape Adare, they sailed nearly due south along the shore of Victoria Land and eventually landed at Cape Crozier on the northeastern tip of Ross Island, where Royds and Wilson climbed to 1,350 feet and viewed the great ice barrier, stretching as far as the eye could see. From Cape Crozier, they steamed along the eastern edge of the barrier, and on January 30th, after emerging from a whiteout in a snowstorm, the eastern extremity of the barrier was reached, where patches of rock were determined to rise 2,000 feet above them. Scott named the new discovery King Edward VII Land. Scott turned about and retraced their route back to McMurdo Sound, where they intended to set up winter quarters. Along the way, they stopped long enough for Scott and Shackleton to take a trip aloft in the balloon, but the balloon developed a leak and was never used again. I was wondering what the balloon was going to be used for. Yeah, so they could get a view from up high of what the landscape was like. Yeah, that was a good idea. I was thinking maybe they were going to use it for emergency purposes or something.
It must have occurred to them that this was almost like going to a different planet. You know, the landscape, the topography of the land and the thickness of the ice, etc., must have just appeared absolutely fantastic to them. And it must have been, you know, really quite a thrilling thing to take part in.
Oh, definitely. No trees, no animals, completely alien landscape that most people had never seen before. After arriving at their winter quarters, the ship was secured by ice anchors to an ice foot, and a 36-foot square hut was built. Two smaller huts were put up to house the magnetic instruments, and the dogs were moved into their kennels. On February 16th, 1902, the sun slipped below the horizon for the first time. It was too late in the season for any long-distance sledge trips, so Scott planned a few short practice trips to test the equipment and the men. As it turned out, Armitage and Bonacci were the only men with a little dog-driving experience. It was hilarious to watch them, but many hard lessons were learned. The first trip was a three-day affair to White Island by Wilson, Shackleton and Ferrar. A hard lesson was learned on this first sledge trip, as the three nearly became the first casualties of the expedition. Distances in the Antarctic are very deceptive, and when plans were made, the three felt the island could easily be reached in a day and a half of sledging. and the men had decided to haul a sledge themselves. It was 2 days before they reached the island, whereupon a blizzard set in and frostbite struck their faces and feet. They were so exhausted from the trip that they could hardly pitch their tent and cook their meal. This trip taught them how little they actually knew about the Antarctic.
Wow.
The next trip was taken by 4 officers and 8 men with 4 sledges. Leader Royds, Quartley, Vince, Weller, Wild, Barnes, Skelton, Evans, Heald, Plumley, Cutlets and Hare. On the morning of March the 4th, the men started out for the Penguin Rookery at Cape Crozier, where they were to leave a canister containing directions on how to find the expedition's winter quarters. Scott was to lead the party, but he had to decline as he had injured his knee in a skiing accident. The dogs did hardly anything but fight. Frostbite attacked. The snow was so soft that they sank in well above their ankles, and progress was so slow that on the second day they had only made 5 miles. The rations got mixed up in the bag, so that a mash of sugar, cheese, butter, soup tablets and chocolate had to all be cooked together. Most of the dogs went lame, and the men were exhausted. So on the fourth day, Royds decided to push ahead with Cutlets and Skelton and send the rest under the leadership of Barnes back to the ship. Royds and his men had a terrible struggle, and after 5 days of hard going, they still hadn't found the rookery. Royds decided to give up on the search and return to the ship as temperatures reached minus 42 degrees Fahrenheit. Wow. And I'm wondering if they're doing all this in the dark, if the sun has gone down for the first time. Do they mean that's gone down for the first time in the winter and in that Antarctic it won't come back up again until 6 months time or 5 months time, or were they meaning
that it's just going down? I think there would be a gradual progression of the darkness expanding to eventually, so that in the darkest part of the winter it would be permanent darkness. So it would be a gradual thing, I would think.
And interesting that they're trying to pull the sledges themselves rather than using the dogs. A lot of things are starting to go wrong already. Royds, Cutlets and Skelton reached the hut in 4 days, but the other men had not been so lucky. Barnes and the returning party, 8 members in all, had arrived to within 4 miles of the ship at a hill called Castle Rock. When they reached the summit, a blizzard came up and reduced visibility to nearly nil. They pitched their tents, and since they couldn't get their cookers to work, frostbite began to set in. An experienced crew would have remained, no matter how uncomfortable, but the novice crew decided to head out into the storm. They soon found themselves on a steep, slippery slope where Evans stepped on a patch of bare ice and tumbled out of sight. Barnes sat down and slid after him, with Quartley following close behind. All 3 men miraculously came to a halt when a patch of soft snow stopped them right at the edge of a precipice with the sea pounding below. A howling dog flashed past and disappeared over the edge. Frank Wild took charge of leading the remaining 5 who were left at the head of the slope. He led them off in the direction of the ship, but suddenly came upon a cliff with the dark sea below. Another step and he would have gone right over the edge. Unfortunately, Vince could get no grip on the slippery ice, and like the dog, he vanished over the edge and into the sea. Wild, Weller, Heald and Plumley were able to fight their way back to the ship. Of the original 12, only 4 had returned. A search party was quickly organised and led by Wild, who came upon Barn, Evans and Quartley wandering about in a daze at Castle Rock. That evening, Royds brought in his party, and so it seemed only 2 men were lost, Vince and Clarence Hare. Hare had last been seen heading back to the abandoned sledges to get his ski boots. 2 days later, a figure came walking down the hill towards the ship. Incredibly, it was Hare, and without even a trace of frostbite. It seems he had fallen down and simply gone to sleep. The snow covered and preserved him as he slept for 36 hours. That is quite incredible, isn't it?
That's amazing.
36 hours sleep under there. Well, I guess they do live, the Eskimos, they live in the igloos, don't they? And the snow is like an insulator. Even though it's 0 degrees, it is an insulator, and it will keep the wind off you, and it will keep the really freezing cold off you as well. Well, they've already lost 2 people. a dangerous expedition, basically. And you imagine you're freezing cold the whole time as well. One more sledging trip was undertaken before winter set in. On Easter Monday, Scott started off with Armitage, Wilson, Ferrar and 8 men with 3 sledges and 9 dogs. The objective was to lay depots towards the south for the use of the sledging parties in the spring. So I guess what they would do is they would go out sort of half the distance that they know that they could go, lay the depot, and then come back to base again. So they knew that they had food stashes along the way so that they could actually go further the next time. So that's what they're doing here. The dogs refused to work and the temperature dropped to minus 47 degrees Fahrenheit. When they became exhausted, the men crawled into their sleeping bags. As Wilson put it, once in, one can do literally nothing but lie as one falls in the tent. Reindeer skin hairs get in your mouth and nose, and you can't lift a hand to get them out. At night, the men would sweat, which would produce a puddle beneath them. And since nothing could be dried, by morning you put on frozen mitts and frozen boots stuffed with frozen grass and rime. There's a fascination about it all, but it can't be considered comfort. 2 more days of this and Scott decided enough was enough. They packed up their gear and headed back to the ship, with everyone learning from this experience. On April 23rd, 1901, the sun sank below the horizon and would not reappear for more than 4 months. There we go. So that's when the sun actually went down. You know, we forget about all the technology we have today, just camping technology, you know, sleeping bags. I mean, that's just a fantastic piece of technology that they never had years ago. You know, they're just under reindeer
pelts. Things, they pull themselves into a sleeping bag while they were standing and then just flop over on their side.
completely worn out from the day. A winter routine was established with each man having his own special task. Royds was in charge of the seamen and petty officers who were employed on routine activities such as watering ship every few days by hacking out blocks of ice and taking them on board to be melted in the boiler. Exercise was a problem as blizzards and extreme cold kept everybody inside for days on end. Birthdays were celebrated by special dinners and a religious service was held each Sunday. The South Polar Times appeared, edited by Shackleton, and all were invited to contribute. The first copy was formally presented to Captain Scott. Some men played cards and chess, while others read and carried out scientific studies. So I guess for the whole of this 4 months, they really kind of gone out and done many of these scientific expeditions, and they're all just having to get on together inside the hut.
But acclimatizing would be a very, very important thing to do in that situation.
Yeah, and I guess also you have the time to do your writing here and write your journal. And they've got the South Polar Times, which I guess must be a sort of newspaper that they worked out that they were going to write, keep track of things that then could be used when they got back, or be sent on the mail vessel when it got there. Yes. Summer sledging began on September the 2nd when Scott and 8 others set out to lay a depot. They were back in 3 days as the conditions were impossible for both men and dogs. A typical sledging camp can best be described from descriptions written in the diaries of the men who fought the extremes. The first step was to set up a small tent just large enough for 3 men to lie down in. Snow was piled up around the outside of the tent in order to hold it down in case of a blizzard. The sledge would be unloaded and the cooker set up inside the tent. One had to be careful when grabbing metal as sometimes your skin would stick right to it. Changing from the day outfit into night gear was a laborious task indeed. First you removed your finnescoes, making sure you left them in the shape of your feet, since they froze as hard as bricks in a few minutes and would be impossible to put on in the morning until one could find a way to thaw them out. Then you had to unlace your leggings, which had to be done with bare hands. Needless to say, a pause was necessary periodically to stuff your hands back in your pants to keep them from frostbite. 3 pairs of socks were pulled on, which had been kept next to the body all day in order to keep them warm. Then came a long pair of fur boots reaching above the knee. then fur trousers, and finally a loose fur blouse. Day socks were often tucked inside the pant leggings in order to keep them warm for the next morning. Then came supper, which consisted of a hoosh made of pemmican cheese, oatmeal, pea flour, and bacon. At bedtime, it was often discussed whether each man should sleep in his own bag or if three should try it together. When it's minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, it is certainly much easier to keep warm with three in a bag. Unfortunately, one could not move without disturbing the others, not to mention the fit of experiencing a leg cramp, which they often did. Condensation of breath was another problem. After a few days, the inside of the tent became covered with a layer of ice, and every time the wind shook it, a shower of ice fell on the men sleeping beneath. Also, their breath froze in their beards and around the necks of their fur coats, which produced a collar as stiff as a board. Shivering fits could last for hours. I should imagine it would have been very difficult as well with the sweating as well. If you've got three of you there inside a sleeping bag and you've got ice that forms underneath you, or the, you know, puddles from the sweat, it's a very difficult situation. Just trying to get to sleep. The next morning it got even difficult. Even more difficult, the whole process would be repeated in reverse. Then Bernacchi wrote, 25 years later, came a ceremony that no one ever talks about. Bathrooms were ruled out since they took too long to dig, and besides, they would just fill up with snow. So feeling like a ham in a sack, each man took his turn loosening his clothes, going out into the snow, facing the wind, and watchfully awaiting a temporary lull. It's a ghastly business. No matter how quick you were, your clothes would fill with snow, and for the next few hours you would walk around with a wet, cold bottom. Some of the men... Not good. Some of the men suffered from dysentery, so one can easily imagine how much misery these men had to sustain when blizzards raged for days on end. And I think we'll leave that there for this week. But I mean, this really gives us an idea of how difficult life was for them, and they're going to be like this for years.
You can't imagine many people of today being prepared to tolerate that. Crikey.
And not thinking that, you know, I'm desperate to get out to the Antarctic so that I've got the freedom to properly discover what I'm capable of. I mean, that was Scott's reason for wanting to go out there. He wanted the freedom to really be tested on what he was capable of. And this is why he pointed out that this was going to make men out of the young fledglings that they had on board. And this big test of endurance and having to get on with everyone. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for part 3 of Captain Scott and the Discovery Expedition later on in the year.